read a passage to you last week from Hebrews chapter 1, verse 1. It says that in times past, that God has spoken to us through the prophets and has done so in many different ways. That passage I use then to springboard into our discussion on the prophet Elijah. Unfortunately, because of the speed with which we're reading through the Bible, I don't have time to dwell on some of these notable people that have done so much in the service of the kingdom of God. And there's so much more that could be said or proclaimed regarding the work that God did through the prophet Elijah. And yet it comes to a close after the part we looked at last week where he recommissioned him and said that one of the things he would do would be to anoint his successor. He then goes to a man named Elisha, and he calls him to follow him, which he does. And that continues for some time until they get near the end of Elijah's time on earth. And Elijah then, the Bible tells us, is taken up into heaven. There are only two people that are mentioned in Scripture as having not died, but been translated to heaven. One of them is Elijah, and the other is Enoch. We know even less about Enoch. So what did that look like? Well, read it again. You'll see the description of the chariots of fire coming out of the heavens and gathering him up. That's what it tells us. So I think that's what it looked like. I think it looked like chariots of fire, something that other than with computer-generated graphics, I don't know that we have the capacity to really imagine that. Prior to its occurrence, though, Elisha requested of him a double portion. So as the Spirit of God had been with Elijah in the proclamations that he had made and the powerful works he had done, Elisha prayed and asked him and asked God for a double portion. So he wanted to do twice as much as Elijah did. Elijah said, if you're here when I'm taken up and you witness it, it will be so. And that's exactly what happened. Elisha received a double portion of the power of God that had resided with the prophet Elijah. So whereas Elijah's ministry had a great deal to do with the message that he declared and God spoke through the prophets, Elisha's ministry had a great deal to do with powerful works and miracles that he performed that demonstrated the truth of God. And so just as God spoke through his prophets, God also works through his prophets. And so today as we look at the prophet Elisha, we're going to focus more on the attention given to the work that God has done through him and the ministry that has been carried out as a result of all that he has done. The passage we're going to be reading from is in 2 Kings chapter 5. Find your place there. We'll stay there. So it'll be easy for you to follow along in verses 1 through 19 as we consider how God works through his prophets. In chapter 5, verse 1, Naaman, commander of the army of the king of Syria, was a great man with his master and in high favor because by him, the Lord had given victory to Syria. He was a mighty man of valor, but he was a leper. Now the Syrians, on one of their raids, had carried off a little girl from the land of Israel, and she worked in the service of Naaman's wife. She said to her mistress, "Would that my lord were with the prophet who is in Samaria, he would cure him of his leprosy." So Naaman went in and told his lord, "Thus and so spoke the girl from the land of Israel." And the king of Syria said, "Go now, and I will send a letter to the king of Israel." So he went, taking with him 10 talents of silver, 6,000 shekels of gold, and 10 changes of clothing. And he brought the letter to the king of Israel, which read, "When this letter reaches you, know that I have sent to you Naaman, my servant, that you may cure him of his leprosy. And when the king of Israel read the letter, he tore his clothes and said, am I God to kill and make alive that this man sends word to me to cure a man of his leprosy? Only consider and see how he is seeking a quarrel with me. So you remember I pointed out that at the end of the period of time where God had led Elijah in the cave and more or less restored and recommissioned him to the work that was before him, he told him that there were three things he was to do. So this is the whisper of the still small voice. He was to choose and appoint his replacement, Elisha. He was also, however, to anoint a new king in Israel, in Samaria. And remember this, we're talking about the northern kingdom. And the third thing was he was to anoint and appoint a king in Syria. Assyria is also known as Aram, and you'll see the name Aram in some translations. And so they have been traditional enemies of Israel, and they have fought back and forth, sometimes one gaining the upper hand, at other times the other. We're in a period of history where after Elijah has appointed a king, God gave that king victory over Samaria, over Israel, in order to judge Israel, in order to punish them. And so Syria, though they are not God followers and they are not people who love him or obey his law, they are just as idolatrous as the Israelites have become. They are being used in a manner to exact the judgment of God against the people of God. But the king that rules them is appointed along with his successors by the prophet in Israel. Now, all of this I'm telling you in order to connect it together, because it comes back together now as the king of Syria is sending Naaman to Israel for healing. All of this is reminding us that in the midst of these geopolitical conflicts that are taking place, where kings in Israel are ruling seemingly without any consideration of God, the king in Syria is ruling and conquering, certainly with no consideration of God. And yet in the midst of it, who is it that all of them are talking to? The man of God. We live in a world where it seems that everything is somewhat disconnected and confused, and that people are ruling here or doing this or doing that. We see all of the different issues that are at work that has caused us to fall into a state not just of confusion and chaos, but all of this has made us dumb. We don't think very well anymore. You can tell by the way people respond on Facebook or in internet posts or the tweets that you read on Twitter or some of the social media that's out there. Even in the news and all the reporting, there are so many things that are being said, and then in conversations that take place between people. JD was telling me that last week he was accused of being a leader of the Klan. That's the dumbest thing I've ever heard. It's just dumb. How would you even come to that conclusion? How could you even, you know, work your way through a series of things to reach that conclusion? These kinds of things are just, they're just out there, and it's causing us to lose our ability to think. But in the midst of the confusion and the chaos and the foolishness that is so much a part of the world that we are living in and right now, where people think they're in control or someone believes themselves to have the right answer or solution, the reality is there is only one answer in all of this. And don't forget, God does not share his glory, neither does he surrender his sovereignty. So that in the midst of whatever mess we make, intelligence must remind us that the truth stands forever. And so we have the opportunity, and we need these times of worship where we are brought back to this correct understanding. So how is it that God works through his prophets? Well, in this first section, verses 1 through 7, we notice that God works through childlike faith. God's sovereignty extends to all nations, not just to Israel. That is clear in the fact that we see the foreign nation of Syria as a part of the conversation of what is happening here. The story involves this nation who, though traditionally enemies with Israel, now is being used for the purpose of God, and even in this passage, to show us that God is still working through them. Notice the description of Naaman in verse 1. It says he was a mighty man of valor. But if you read on there in the latter part, it says, because by him the Lord had given victory to Syria. So even though Syria didn't serve God, where did their victory come from? It came from God. Naaman was a mighty man of valor. Why? Because of the work that God had done in his life. So even though he was perhaps unaware of it, God was still at work. It reminds us of what Jesus teaches us, that there is no turning, there is no sleeping, but he is always at work. And so we have this continual reminder of the power of God and the sovereignty of God that is being carried out. And in this case, as Naaman's victories in battle brought judgment on Israel for their idolatry. But then notice how God directed Naaman. He was a leper. And so he had this disease that afflicted him. In Syria, it was not treated in the same way as it was in Israel. And it is possible that his particular disease was not so debilitating that it had limited his ability to serve in the military. Nonetheless, it still is a constant affliction and will ultimately result in his death. And he knows that. The child that is spoken of, it says in verse 2, had been carried off, a little girl who was taken in a raid against Israel and now worked in the service of Naaman's household, in particular for his wife. She says, "Would that my Lord were with the prophet in Samaria, he would heal him." Now notice that no one in Samaria believes that Elisha has the ability to heal, and certainly no one in Syria does. All of the rulers and the mighty men and the men of valor and the kings and all of the political maneuvering and all of the other things that are taking place, no one even considers the possibility that God could heal this problem. And yet here this little girl, this child, has a simple childlike faith in the prophet of God and says, well, if he was in Samaria, Elisha would heal him. The work that he does was so profound. God directed Naaman through a captive child to the prophet Elisha. God is bringing the world literally to himself and to the man of God. This child had greater faith than the king and the leaders of Israel. And the contrast of her faith in comparison to the lack of it on the part of those that are in such great positions of power is startling. It reminds us, as we consider the gravity of the issues of our day and as we consider the enormity of those issues spread all over the entire globe, we would oftentimes despair at the idea or notion that God would be able to effect meaningful change in any of that, and yet he reminds us in his word that he can literally move nations with the testimony of a child. God is able. He just needs us to trust him. Naaman immediately accepts the advice of this child and requests permission to go to Israel. The Syrian gods, Rimmon he refers to, which is a Syrian version of Baal, have been unable to heal him or help him. So he wants to go to Israel and seek out the God of Israel. So that now the nations literally are coming with letters from the king to allow him passage. The king of Syria writes a letter to the king of Israel and directs Naaman to go. He does not mention in the letter that he's sending him to the prophet. He says, I'm sending him to the king. The assumption is, and it is an assumption, so it doesn't state this, but I'm going to interpret it a little bit from my perspective. The assumption is that the king in Syria would had to have believed that if there is a man of God in Israel who has the power to heal leprosy, then the king of Israel would surely know it. So that if I send him to the king will automatically direct him to the prophet. But notice what the king of Israel does. He says, who is this man that he would expect me? Am I God? Can I kill and heal? Can I restore what is sick? This is nothing more than a ruse in order to create division between us so that he will have an excuse to attack us. Notice what happens. He's instantly defensive. Chaos and crazy makes us defensive as well as dumb. Now, I'm starting to feel another sermon emerge out of that, and all the points begin with D's. So we'll see how that goes, because I didn't plan that, by the way. And I'm not sure yet whether it's inspired. But it's certainly true. When chaos and crazy and all of the stuff that we're experiencing in these days, it makes us defensive. Why is that? The reason for defensiveness is because we need a scapegoat. We need something to blame or someone to blame. We need somewhere to put all of these feelings that we don't know what to do with or that we are unable to resolve. So rather than trust and faith and confidence and love and grace and mercy, we turn to this defensiveness. We're just waiting for the next boot to drop. And that's where we're living today. Everybody in America is living with the expectation of bad news just around the corner. We're expecting it because it's been so terrible. We're looking at the year that we're living in and we're thinking, what's next? We've already had pandemic. We are now having rioting. We have division on a nationwide scale at a level that has not been seen in years. We have the kind of uprising and confusion taking place within the political agenda. We have an economy that is faltering. We have people out of work at a higher rate than ever before. We have all of these problems that are brewing. Now we're told that we can expect pestilence. It's hot outside, and we're going to be in a dry, hot summer season because it's never hot and humid in Missouri in July. So why would we think that it would be this year? And then what did I hear? I heard that we've got a horde of locusts on the way. A 17-year hatch of locusts. Sounds biblically epic, doesn't it? And yet, in the midst of all of this, trying to find a way to explain it away or to locate it somewhere else so that we can manage it is never going to work. The king was defensive, so much so that he tore his clothes. He demonstrates his lack of faith because he never even considers a biblical solution. He never even considers the prophet would have an answer or that God would have a word that he does not. Elisha hears about it, verse 8. God not only works through childlike faith, but he works in unexpected ways. In verse 8, when Elisha, the man of God, heard the king of Israel had torn his clothes, he sent to the king saying, "Why have you torn your clothes? Let him come now to me, that he may know that there is a prophet in Israel." So Naaman came with his horses and chariots and stood at the door of Elisha's house. And Elisha sent a messenger to him saying, "Go and wash in the Jordan 7 times and your flesh shall be restored and you shall be clean." But Naaman was angry and went away saying, "Behold, I thought that he would surely come out to me and stand and call upon the name of the Lord his God and wave his hand over the place and cure the leper. Are not Abana and Pharpha, the rivers of Damascus, better than all the waters of Israel? Could I not wash in them and be clean?" So he turned and went away in a rage. But his servants came near and said to him, "My father, it is a great word the prophet has spoken to you. Will you not do it? Has he actually said to you, 'Wash and be clean'?" So he went down, dipped himself 7 times in the Jordan according to the word of the man of God, and his flesh was restored like the flesh of a child, and he was clean. God works in unexpected ways. Elisha hears of the situation and sends for Naaman. When he says that he may know there is a prophet in Israel, the message is intended not just for Naaman, but the message is for the king of Israel as well. He's reminding the king that there is a prophet in the land, that there is a word of God that would direct them, that there is a power that holds authority over all things, including disease. And so his message to the king of Israel, as well as for Naaman, is you come and I'll show you. God always demonstrates for us with great clarity his power and authority. And it is oftentimes in the midst of circumstances where man has exhausted every resource and has found every opportunity of his own lacking. As this has unfolded before them, God now works in unexpected ways. And the prophet says, send him to me. He'll know there's a prophet in the land, but so will you. So Naaman comes, and he comes with his entourage of chariots and horses and all of his wealth and his power and dignity. But Elisha doesn't even come out to meet him. He sends a servant out and says, give him this message. Go wash in the Jordan 7 times, you'll be healed. He's angry. What does he want? He wants to experience the prophet making a fuss over him. He's looking for a big ritual. He wants a performance that will draw attention to himself. And so this is all about him receiving the honor and dignity that he believes he has earned or that is owed. Or he is operating off of the false assumption that the God of Israel works in the same way as the false gods of Syria. And that the only hope of any sort of healing would come from an elaborate display. We are reminded once again of Elijah's message from God that came not through the fire or the earthquake or the wind, but through the quiet voice of a whisper. So also, God often leads us to do things that are simple and that are going to draw little attention and certainly will make nothing of us other than humility. And so Naaman is angry. He's not going to do it. This is ridiculous. I knew it was a waste of time. And he spins on his heel, and away he goes. Once again, God speaks through the lowly, and the servants of Naaman say, come on, man. What he's asking you to do is not a big deal. You've come all this way. Isn't it worth a shot? What if he had asked you, some of the translations have that a little bit differently than the English Standard Version. What if he'd asked you to do some great thing, some epic quest? Would you have done it then? Well, sure, the implication is yes, you would have done it then. Because then when it was done and you had completed the quest and you had received your reward for it of healing from the leprosy, then you could declare how great you are. But when you get back to Syria and they say, what did the prophet do for you? Well, he told me to go down to the Jordan River and submerge my head in the muddy water 7 times. That's it. That's it. That's what it did. It's not grand and it's not glorious and it doesn't draw attention to the person, but it demonstrates with great and specific clarity that God works in ways that are oftentimes going to be contrary to our thinking, and he does it on purpose in order to remind us who's really in charge. Naaman obeys the word of the Lord, and instantly he's healed. Not only is he healed, but it says that all of his skin, not just the leprous parts, but all of his skin is made like a child. And so he's not only healed, but he looks like he's got a killer moisturizing regimen. Think how well that would go on QVC. God restores him and does so in an amazing and miraculous way. Notice his response. Thirdly, God works in all people. Then he returned to the man of God. He and all his company came and stood before him, and he said, behold, I know that there is no God in all the earth but in Israel. Naaman makes a declaration that is priceless. In fact, if you're going to mark a passage out of 2 Kings 5 in your Bible, mark this one. Because he says, I know that there is no God in all of the earth except in Israel. Only the God of Israel. And so now what we're seeing is not just a healing, but we're seeing a conversion. We're seeing something beyond the limit of a miraculous event. We're seeing a spiritually miraculous event. He has turned his heart and his mind, not just because of the healing that he has experienced, but I'm sure also in conjunction with the humility that has gone along with it. So then he says, accept now a present from your servant. Verse 16, but he said, as the Lord lives, before whom I stand, I will receive none. And he urged him to take it, but he refused. Then Naaman said, if not, please let there be given to your servant 2 mule loads of earth. For from now on, your servant will not offer burnt offering or sacrifice to any god but to the Lord. I believe that what happens to Naaman in this experience is a genuine conversion. I think that he's experiencing salvation in a way that is turning his heart. Now, he's going to go back to Syria, and since Elisha won't accept his gifts and all of this other stuff, he doesn't know what to do. And so he wants to continue this, and he doesn't want to worship the false gods that are so present in his world. And so he says, let's load up as much dirt as we can from this place. It was believed in the ancient world that if altars were built from the dirt in which the gods reigned supreme, that it would allow him to worship and give him a greater connection. It's unlikely he's going to be coming back to Israel to worship. And so he takes 2 mule loads of earth back to Syria, where he constructs an altar in which he makes offering and sacrifice to the God of Israel that he has encountered. And he does so that now what is established in Syria is a presence for the worship of God that didn't exist before, reminding us that God began long ago when he told Abraham, I will make of your seed many nations. What was true then remains true today, and what we see here is nothing more than just a very simple and straightforward gospel presentation of the salvation and work of God. What was true then remains true today. Only God is able to heal us from our sinfulness and the sickness that is associated with it. Only God can heal us from all of the brokenness of a world that is so steeped in corruption that it doesn't even realize how desperate it is. Only God can restore us to that for which we were created. And I assure you, if 2020 doesn't do anything else, it should at least remind you that this is not the creation he intended. This is the brokenness that sin has caused. And what he is leading us to is something that will restore all of this when the day comes when there will be no more tears and there will be no more pain and there will be no more death. Then we will celebrate in the great glory of our God. And it will be because there was a day when he called us to a humble confession that he alone is God. God does a great work, and he does it in all nations, and then he distributes it out. Notice, if Israel isn't going to worship God, then God will use Syrians to worship God. If America is not going to worship God, God will find someone else that will declare his name. But God's name will be praised. His greatness and glory will be demonstrated. He owes us nothing. We owe him everything. I love the story of Elisha. I love the power with which he does the work that God has called him for. And it reminds us that God, as he worked through his prophets, continues to prophetically work through his people today to declare his grace, his glory, his healing, his forgiveness, his truth. So yes, it's a tough time to be alive. No tougher than when Elisha lived. And it's a great time for us to be reminded that even if we don't have the solution to all the problems that this world has before it, we can be sure that when it is all said and done, they will know there has been a word of the Lord, a prophet, and
remember.